Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why is grief such a complicated process, and what else do we fear losing if we allow ourselves to move on? Author Jodi Picoult's latest novel explores the disappearance of an elephant behavior scientist when her daughter Jenna is just 3 years old. 10 years later, Jenna misses her mother more than ever and is driven to answer the question of whether her mother is dead or whether she vanished on purpose and left her little girl behind. The book is called Leaving Time. It's Jodi Picoult's 22nd, following bestsellers including The Storyteller, Change of Heart, and My Sister's Keeping. She's in town to speak tonight as part of the Highland Park United Methodist Church Authors Live series, and we are happy she could make time for us today. Jodi, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
You've said that you start your books with a what-if question.
Right.
What was that in this case?
I have three children. My youngest is a daughter, and she was headed off to college. And for the first time, I started to think about being an empty nester, and it totally freaked me out, more than I thought it was going to. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was kind of mulling over that in my mind when I was in a doctor's office reading a magazine, and I found this fact that just stopped me cold, which was that in the wild, in an elephant herd, a mother and daughter elephant stay together their whole lives until one of them dies. And I thought, why don't we do that? That seems very humane. And, you know, I started to dive a little bit more into the world of wild elephants and found out they have extraordinary powers of cognition, of empathy, of a lot of things that we tend to think of as solely human. And I realized pretty quickly that if I was going to write a book about being left behind and about how the people we love never really leave us, I could wrap it up very beautifully in a metaphor about elephants.
This book, not to geek out too much, but it really is full of great elephant facts. Like, aside from the story, which is very compelling, and you actually traveled across the world to get your research.
Yeah, I actually spent my time in two places. One was the Elephant Sanctuary in Tennessee, which is one of our two large elephant sanctuaries in the U.S. They rescue former zoo and circus elephants. It's kind of like the best retirement home ever for an elephant. And they don't have that many, but, you know, every little bit helps. And I got to work with them because one of the main characters in the book, the one who vanishes, Alice Metcalf, runs an elephant sanctuary with her husband. So I needed to learn how a sanctuary runs, what the philosophies are. They were very kind about opening up their facility to me and teaching me everything I needed to know. And then I needed to see elephants in the wild like Alice would have when she was studying them. So I went to Botswana and I worked with an elephant researcher who studies the migration of herds in the Thule Block. And from her, I learned how to collar an elephant, how to look at tracks in the dust and be able to see where a herd is moving, how to tell elephants apart by the ridges in their ears. You know, all the things that come out, like you said, as facts in the book. And every story that you read about elephants in the book is adapted from either something I saw or something that happened at the elephant sanctuary or something that happened in the wild that this researcher observed.
Was there anything that you learned that you just had to get it into the book, even if it meant a small digression in the story? I mean, was there something that you knew you wanted to put in there?
Yeah. I mean, the whole book was really about the grieving process of elephants. So I didn't really have to tweak anything to get that in there. I mean, there are some amazing facts, like, for example, the fact that elephants that come across the bones of other elephants not only pick them up and get very quiet and somber and reverential with their ears and their tail drooping, but they will return back to the site where an elephant died for years after their death, and we see that same behavioral change. It's like going to visit a gravesite if you're a human. They will break into facilities to take the bones that researchers are working with and bring them back to the spot where that elephant died. So things like that were pretty amazing. But the thing that I really did want to touch upon, which was hard to fit into the book just because Alice's recollections happened in the past 10 years earlier, was what's going on with elephants today and poaching in Africa. And so there is a very slight grazing of that and what's happening to the elephants that are left behind when their matriarchs are being shot, you know, to death by poachers and their ivories being taken away, their tusks. I really wanted to at least make my readers aware of that conversation so that they could, after they fall in love with elephants, find a way to help support them as well.
So the book opens when Jenna is 13, and she's at that age where questions that haven't been answered before that you haven't cared very much about start to mean something, right? You have this kind of exposure to the world and you're starting to understand things. She's got no one she can ask about where her mother is. Her father's in a mental institution.
Right.
And her grandmother just won't go there.
Right.
So she takes matters into her own hands.
Right. And, you know, the thing about being 13, and I love teenage narrators because they have a built-in BS meter. So, you know, you can't put anything past them. Jenna has to figure out, who am I? But it's really hard to figure out who you are when you don't know where you came from. And so ultimately, her search for her mom is her way of figuring out her place in the world and, you know, and making sense of the nonsensical. Why hasn't my mom been with me for the past decade? You know, so I love Jenna because she's a fighter and she isn't willing to let an unanswered question lie, which is actually very similar to the way her mother would have been as a scientist.
Yeah, it's interesting to sort of have those parallel narratives and find similarities between the mm-hmm. characters.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it is. It's fun. It's fun when characters almost become larger than you expect them to be when you first create them. And very much so, what I love about Jenna is that she talks a lot about how her mother would have said, you know, a hypothesis is a hunch dressed up in fancy vocabulary. She's always trying to think, how would my mother have seen this conundrum? Can I look through her eyes? Can I read her journals and try to find what's between the lines to figure out where she might be? By the same token, when we read Alice's journals, she's always talking about the things that you can't use science to explain, that there is a 2% of science that nobody really gets, that it just happens. And that's exactly what Jenna's looking for, the inexplicable.
So she goes to see this psychic named Serenity, who I loved, her best days as a psychic appear to be behind her when she and Jenna meet. Tell us a little bit about Serenity.
Serenity is one of my all-time favorite characters. She is a failed psychic. She used to have a real knack for finding missing people, in particular missing children, kids who were abducted. She would be able to set law enforcement people on their trail. And then she winds up getting this gig as with a syndicated show, basically, because she does a reading on live TV for someone who is named Cleo, who's like an Oprah character. And she reveals that this woman had a child that nobody knew she had. And Cleo gets an Emmy. And as a reward, they give her her own syndicated show. And so she's doing like really high profile psychic work in front of a national television audience. And on that show, she tells a senator, a very well-known senator whose son has been abducted, that his son is alive and well. And that doesn't turn out so well for her. And she winds up saying, you know, something that she didn't really ever see. She later on says the only thing she was seeing was an Emmy, and she had no vision of this son alive and well. And as a result of that, she loses all credibility and she crashes and burns really hard. And she then reinvents herself, not as a real psychic, but as a swamp witch, as she would call it, somebody who just can do cold readings really, really well and make a living by doing these cold readings and lying to people, you know, when they come to her trying to connect with the dead. So she is what Jenna finds at the beginning of the book. She's pretty cheap, which is what Jenna needs because she's 13 years old. And, you know, even Jenna says, I don't think she's the real deal. I don't know about that, but I'm willing to part with $10 to find out.
So do you believe in psychics and the things that they say they can do?
So I have worked with ghost hunters before for another book of mine called Second Glance, and I was by all means the biggest skeptic in the world. And I went out with these guys who now have a TV show called Ghost Hunters. Back when I knew them, they were just Roto-Rooter plumbers. I'm seriously not making that up. And they took me out, and there were things I experienced in their company that to this day I cannot explain. Pennies turning up that were not in a room 2 minutes earlier when I was the last one in and out of that room. Things that that then connected. These pennies were all dated up between 1968 and 1973 in a house that people alleged was haunted. And eventually, after these guys decided maybe there was paranormal activity there, they did some research. And these pennies tied into the fact that two people died in that house in 1968 and in 1973. And, you know, to find 25 pennies that were not there 5 minutes before, all dated within that range, is really weird because most of those coins are out of circulation. That was a weird feeling, you know, or to feel all the hair rise up on the back of your neck and take a picture facing backward. And when you turn around, it's just pitch black. There's nothing there. But to have this white, misty thing in the viewfinder of the camera, if you have a paranormal experience, you should believe. And if you haven't, you shouldn't. And they're the first ones to tell you that. So there was definitely stuff I couldn't explain. And that's one of the things that Serenity says in the book. Can't explain it, you know, can't deny it. That's the way she thinks about the paranormal. And when I was doing research for Serenity, I went down and I met with a guy named Chip Coffey, who is in Atlanta. He is a famous TV psychic who I was put in touch with by these ghost hunters because I guess they all know each other.
They travel in the same circles.
Yeah, they do. And Chip was great. A lot of his worldview, a lot of the way he thinks became Serenity's voice because he's very funny and very irreverent. And, you know, he said to me right off the bat, I won't do a reading for someone who doesn't invite me to do a reading. So I said, okay, well, you have permission if anything comes floating by. You know, you go ahead and tell me. And the whole time we're talking, you know, it's like you and I were facing each other and his eyes keep drifting over my shoulder. And finally I said, what are you looking at? And he goes, oh, there's a guy over there on a cell phone. There's nobody there on their cell phone. But he could see apparently a spirit talking in this hotel. And I said, well, what's he doing there? And he said, well, he was probably here at some point in his life. And he's kind of rewalking those steps again. And he was the one who explained to me the levels that the world might be seen as almost like an animator's cells. Mm-hmm. So
sort of layered.
Yeah. Like there could be ghosts sitting here in the studio with us right now who you might have interviewed at some time who've passed on but don't even know they're dead and they're just hanging out waiting for their turn. Things like that. So we all inhabit the same space and every now and then we cross paths. There were things Chip said to me that nobody should have known. Which was really impressive. Things about my family that have never been in print, have never been published. And then I had this really wild experience where my grandparents, my grandmother's 101 years old. My grandfather.
Still with you.
Yes.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yes, still with me. And when I interviewed Chip, she was 99 and her husband, my grandfather, was 101. And they were both alive and well and kicking. And I did this interview and, you know, we talked about their children, things like that. And then I had to call Chip back about 6 months later, and it was for a follow-up question. I called him out of the blue, so he didn't know I was calling. And in that 6 months, my grandfather had passed away. And my grandmother was getting really sad, and she had been having dreams about my grandfather coming to sit on the end of her bed and talk to her. And I was talking to Chip about something completely different that had nothing to do with my grandparents. It was about Serenity, asking if something was a legitimate response for her. And he interrupted me. He said, your grandfather wants your grandmother to know it's not her time yet.
Wow.
And he had no idea my grandfather died. I mean, unless he was, I don't know, stalking records in New York, you know. And I just thought, wow, why would he know that? You know, to me, that's really interesting. Do I know if that's the way it works? I don't. None of us are going to know until we die. But I sure would like to hope, you know.
Well, I was interested because a lot that Serenity says about learning to kind of harness this gift that you have and having people, you know, voices all the time. Mm-hmm. It sounds a lot like what a novelist has to work through.
That's exactly what I say. I'm Serenity because I get asked all the time, how do you create these characters? And I can't ever answer that. I say, I'm sorry, but I don't feel like I create them. I feel like I am watching a movie that none of you can see or hear. And it's my job to tell you what's on the screen. And the characters really talk to me. I actually hear their voices. I've long said that writing is successful schizophrenia. I get paid to hear these voices, you know, and basically they come to me, they're in my head, and I am just writing down what they say to me, which is very much what a medium does, I think.
We're speaking this hour with author Jodi Picou. Her new novel is called Leaving Time. She's in town to speak tonight at SMU's Hughes Trigg Theater as part of Highland Park United Methodist Church's Authors Live series. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Jodi Picco. Her newest novel is called Leaving Time. She's in town to speak tonight at SMU's Hughes Trigg Theater as part of Highland Park United Methodist Church's Authors Live series. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Another thing that Serenity tells Virgil, who is the former police detective who gets wrapped up in this, trying to solve this case, is to stop trying to make things happen and just let them happen.
Right.
And I wonder if that's another thing that you relate to as a novelist.
You know, I do think that it's a very typical mistake for beginning novelists to force a story. I can see it sometimes when I go back and I read things that I was writing, you know, when I was in creative writing programs, because I wanted to shoehorn them towards the message I wanted to create. I have learned to know the beginning of a story and the end of a story and to let the characters do the work in the middle. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there is a little of that. But overall, I'm such a planner in life that I can't say I'm very good with letting things just flow. You know, I have friends who say, yeah, I'm just going to go on a vacation. I'm going to see where I wind up staying. I couldn't do that. I would probably die. You know, but yeah, I do think that serenity is very much about letting the universe take care of things, letting the universe give you signs that direct you in different ways. And certainly Virgil, as this detective who botched the case of this woman who disappeared, you know, Jenna's mom, and is now revisiting it, is, I think, looking for a new modus operandi because it didn't work the last time.
He's we should say, by the way, that there are four characters, Alice, Jenna, Serenity, and Virgil, are all narrating different sections of the book. Mm-hmm. I was going to ask you initially, as I was reading the book, if that was really challenging. But then I read somewhere that you sometimes write two novels simultaneously.
Yeah, very rarely. But I've written these young adult novel with my daughter. It was conceived, her idea. It was called Between the Lines, and we just finished the sequel, which is called Off the Page. And when I'm writing those books with Sammy, I'm also simultaneously writing an adult book. I don't write two adult books at the same time. My head would probably explode. But but when it comes to writing multiple narrators, I really like doing that. I always think about narrative as a stream. Mm-hmm. And the story keeps going all the time, just like a stream would. And lined up on the edge of the stream are different pairs of Wellington boots. And when you step into a pair, you get into the stream and it flows over your feet. And how you feel is different depending on what those boots feel like, what size they are, what socks you're wearing. You know, that's what makes each narrator a little bit different. They pick up the stream at the point that they step into it and they carry you a little further down the stream. And then you put on someone else's boots and you walk a little further. That to me is what it's like to try on different narratives. It's like, you know, shrugging on a piece of clothing.
And is the voice always easy to pick up in your head as well?
Yeah, because that's, like I said, I don't create that. I hear it. And they're very real to me. And, I'm very cognizant of the fact that I have to be true to the way that they're talking in my head, because you should be able to pick up any of my books, open them in the middle randomly, read a page and know who's speaking based on syntax and dialect and what they're saying and the way they're saying it. No two characters should sound alike. Certainly Jenna at 13 is going to sound very different than Virgil, and Virgil's going to sound very different than Serenity. And, you know, I would defy you to have trouble picking up any page of Leaving Time and not know who's speaking.
You've been writing full time for more than 20 years now. Is mm-hmm. that right? I'm curious, because when you're a published novelist, like, you're expected to be really, really good. And yet anything that you do for two decades, inevitably you get better at, or you make different choices. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how you feel about things you wrote early in the time when you were professionally successful, mm-hmm. but you were younger, you were a different person, you mm-hmm. were at a different place in your life.
It's a great question. And I actually had a chance to address that head on when I was at my former publisher, and they wound up buying the rights to some of my earliest books to republish in paperback. And, you know, these were books that had sold like nothing. And, and they said to me, here, take a look at them. You can make any changes you want before we publish them in paperback. And I thought, ooh, you know, do I go through them and make changes and create a different story for the 2,000 people who actually read the book the first time out, or you know, or do I you know, keep it the way it was? And when I read through these stories, I completely stood by the characters, their voices, and the plot. The only changes that I made were very grammatical, where I used to have to take, say, 20 words to turn a metaphor. Mm-hmm. I can do it in 5 now.
Yeah.
So I think over the years I've become a more skilled technical writer, but I do believe that you're born a storyteller or you're not. And so I actually stand by the stories that I told back then. I think that if I were to revise some of my earlier novels, they would just be a little cleaner in terms of language in the writing.
I know that you're a huge fan of Alice Hoffman's,
yeah.
And I've had the pleasure to interview her as well. How has she influenced the way you think about good writing?
So Alice was the woman who made me a fan after college. Mm-hmm. You know when you go to college and you read all these books that you probably would never read, you know, and and then you're exhausted and you never want to pick up fiction again. I mean, that's if you're an English major like I was. And when I got out of college, the first book that I read was Turtle Moon. And I fell in love again. I said, oh, right, that's why I used to love reading.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, Alice could write anything and I would read it and give it to everyone for Christmas. What I love about Alice is that she is she has an uncanny ability to describe love and to do it in a way with magical realism that makes the world seem alive when you fall in love. And I love that concept. And I admire her writing so much. One of the high points of my career was to be able to meet her and to become friends with her. And she's just as wonderful as I wanted her to be. It was the coolest thing.
That's always a risk, though, right?
No, it is.
What if someone's terrible?
Yes, and it's happened, but mm-hmm. not with Alice. Alice mm-hmm. is awesome. And, you know, what she really has taught me is I think to pay attention at the line level to language. Mm. There is such beauty in her writing. There's poetry in her writing. And that's something a lot of fiction writers neglect. They're very concerned about the drive of the plot or even the feel of the character, but nobody notices the poetry of the language because that's considered to be more literary fiction than it is commercial fiction. Certainly when I started learning how to write when I was at Princeton in their creative writing program, I was not a fiction writer. I actually started with poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think she reminded me to go back to my roots.
It seems in some ways, I mean, obviously you have to be conscious of all of this as you go. And yet you can get really hung up in the same way that, you know, people who have a big task spend 45 minutes arranging pencils on their desk. And I wonder if it's that way, too, when you're thinking about, OK, I want the characters to feel very real and I want the language to sing and I want the plot to move.
You don't think about it. You just go.
Yeah.
You don't overthink it. Like I get a lot of beginning writers who say, you know, I've read Stephen King's On Writing and I read Anne Lamott. And those are all great things to do. And they're wonderful books. But we don't need to know how Stephen King does it and Lamott does it. What you need to figure out is how you do it. And honestly, that is the scariest thing of all because it means sitting down and writing. And sometimes the fear there is that whatever you create is not going to be as good as you'd hoped. That's a very common fear for a beginning writer, but it's something you have to push through or you're never going to be a writer. So, but, you know, the other thing about you mentioned the idea of doing this for 20 years. Honestly, I work really hard to give my readers the best book that I can write at any given moment because it is really easy to rest on your laurels. And let's face it, there are a lot of writers who do that and mm-hmm. phone in a performance or, you know, write the same book 20 times over. I don't ever want to do that, which is why I try really hard to challenge myself, whether that means using multiple narrative voices, using a structure that is a little different, embedding a graphic novel or a CD into a book because it's important for the characterizations of the main characters, something that really throws me off my game so that I really have to pay attention hard.
Do you have confidence now every time you start that you will end up with something that you like and can sell?
If I do not feel I have confidence that anything I write would sell.
Mm-hmm.
But if I do not think it's something that is the best I could do at that moment, I will get rid of that book. And I've done it.
And where do those – are they just on a file in like an old Apple IIe in your basement?
Yeah, they're in boxes. Yeah. Actually, they're at the University of Massachusetts now because they just took all my old papers.
Mm-hmm. That's a little bit daunting, isn't it?
Giving your papers up?
Yeah.
It's actually really funny because I didn't have all the boxes of research and my drafts, because how self-serving would it be to think, I should hold on to these because one day somebody's going to want my paper? I mean, that is just so conceited. So I threw out a few of them. And then when I was asked, my husband was like, please take them. Please take them. I want them out of the garage. You know, so we donated them. And it was actually very nice. And, you know, God knows if there'll ever be anyone who needs to write a PhD thesis on me. But if they do, UMass Amherst is the place to go.
How do you decide when there's a new author who you will blurb and who you won't?
I get about 50 requests a week from authors to blurb. I refuse to blurb self-published novels, and that's for my own philosophical reasons. And the other people, I try really hard to help when I can. I especially try to help first-time female writers, because they are probably at the greatest risk to never have a review. And I think if you are lucky enough to have achieved some success in this business, being able to pay it forward is one of the greatest gifts that you have. I was lucky. I still remember a blurb from Anne Hood on my second novel, and she wrote me a note and said, I wasn't going to be able to get to this, but I was moving houses and I packed up everything I had to read and I grabbed your galley as I was leaving on a plane, and I loved it. Hmm. And I've never forgotten that and how much it meant to me. And now I know her and I'm friends with her. So it's, you know, it's a wonderful circle. But if I can give that leg up to someone, that makes me feel really good. And it's a delight to be able to help people find great writers they might not otherwise find.
Why don't young female writers get reviewed? Is it because we assume that they're writing, like, I'm using air quotes here, like girl books?
Yes. So here's the problem. They're probably not writing girl books. But if they are women, people assume they are writing girl books.
That there's anything wrong with a girl book if someone wants to read or
absolutely.
Write one.
Absolutely. You know what? I mean, chick lit is a great genre. And I don't know about you or your readers, but or your listeners, but I have wide reading tastes, and I want to read a good book. I don't really care where it is in a bookstore or how it's labeled. So I am not even the one to talk about this, although I've championed the cause. There is a group called VIDA. And they have done these statistics. It's VIDA, if anyone wants to Google it. They've done statistics about how few female reviewers there are at literary review outlets and how few female authors are reviewed. And there are gender disparities in almost every review outlet, from the New York Times to the New York Review of Books to, you know, the New Republic, all of these institutions. When they crunch the numbers, they've been doing it, I think, for 3 years now, possibly four. Sometimes it was as much as 70% to 30%. And it's just a huge gender bias, which is really interesting given that women buy more books than men. There are readers. And I don't know why it is. I'm very proud and delighted that VIDA raised attention. And it's really important for readers to know that this disparity exists. Because if you're looking around your library or your bookstore and you're looking for a new book, pick one up by a woman, because you're going to be doing some good in the world.
I'm always astonished. I read a lot of books for this job, but I read a lot of book reviews as well. And a lot of them are really incorrect. And I wonder, I mean, just like giant details. And I wonder if you can sense in reading a review of your own work, certainly, but even of something else that you've also read, the finished work.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to give you a great example.
Okay.
This book, Leaving Time, debuted at number one on the New York Times list. Yay.
Congratulations.
Right? Thank you. So exciting, right? So it's coming out in print on, I think, the 2nd of November, but we see the advance copies, you know, digitally. And they have a tiny blurb about what it's about. And it says something like, woman searches for her missing mother, an elephant researcher. And I'm thinking, in whose life, mind, or culture is a 13-year-old a woman? Did you even read the flap? You know, I mean, I just wonder about that. The real truth is, and it's very, very sad, is that there are very few people like you, Chris. Most people who review books skim or don't read, or, you know, just go by the press materials, especially in this country. in America, people don't have time to read. And, you know, I think book reviewers do, if that's their dedicated job. But a lot of time, you know, you do an interview with a paper and you're talking to a guy who's usually covering high school football, you know, who got this particular gig. And, you know, you're doing your best you can to just sort of give them an inkling of what the book is about so that it's somewhat accurate. You know, it's the nature of today's coverage of books, which has shrunk dramatically, unfortunately.
Where do you go when you want to know whether something is worth your time?
I go to usually the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. They're one of my favorite book sections because they exist and because they tend to review books of a wide-ranging coverage, you know, everything from literary fiction to commercial fiction to genre fiction to nonfiction that I would be interested in, that real people seem to read. I am not a big fan of the New York Times because I don't usually tend to read, you know, translations of Ukrainian folktales or whatever it is that they're reviewing that week. It's very esoteric, mm-hmm. the New York Times. And I think the Washington Post is much more reflective of what real people want to read.
I want to go back for a minute to the project that you did with your daughter, because I'm wondering, on the one hand, it's this great thing that you can share. On the other hand, this is what you do. And I would imagine the pressure on her is pretty strong.
You know, when she conceived that book, she was 13 years old. Mm-hmm. And she told me about it when I was stuck in traffic on book tour in L.A. And
was she with you in the car? Was
no, she no, no. She called me up. Uh-huh. She said, Mom, I think I have a really good idea for a book. I said, all right, hit me. And she said, well, what if every time you closed a book, the characters inside it had lives and personalities different from the roles they played in the book, but when a reader opened it, they had to jump back into act one, scene one. And what if there was this prince in a fairy tale who was really sick of being a prince in a fairy tale, but nobody knew that because they only saw him as a prince until there was this 15-year-old reader who was kind of a loner, and she was obsessed with the children's fairy tale because the prince who was illustrated in it was really, really hot. And one day she realized he was talking to her and wanted her help getting out of the book. And I thought, that's brilliant. I mean, it's a literary crush. Who doesn't have a literary crush? You know, Mr. Darcy, I'm sure, is waiting outside for me right now. And, you know,
or he might be in the studio, if it turns out.
Right, because like we said, he could be a spirit. You know, so I really feel like she tapped into something very universal, mm-hmm. that wasn't even just for teens. It was for grown people as well. And I thought this would be a really interesting thing for us to do together. So I asked her if she was interested in doing that. And she said yes, because she had no idea what she was getting into. And we literally spent several years crafting that book, plotting it, then writing it during a summer, editing it during another summer, and then touring three continents for it. We would write side by side at a desk, literally speaking the entire book out loud with one of us typing. Hmm. And it was very much a learning experience because I thought I knew best. You know, I've had the experience, she hasn't. And there were things that we'd argue over, some of which I won. Like, for example, she thought the prince should be blonde, and clearly he is dark. You know, and other things I realized that she was right about, like making a fairy tale a little darker. Mm-hmm. I had to learn to trust her instincts.
My guest is author Jodi Picou. Her latest novel is called Leaving Time. She's in town to speak tonight as part of the Highland Park United Methodist Church Authors Live series, and that talk is taking place at SMU's Hughes Trigg Theater. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes, and you can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with novelist Jodi Picou. Her new novel, Leaving Time?
You know, that's a really, really good question. And I can tell you the answer.
I've said it both ways already.
Yeah, it's Leaving Time.
Leaving Time.
The story behind that, actually, is that the book was originally called The Elephant Graveyard. And my publisher said, I don't like the title. I said, what don't you like about it? And they said, we don't like the word elephant and we don't like the word graveyard. So they said, can you find another title? And my daughter, the one who inspired this book, she did go to college. And when we went to freshman drop-off, you know, we had been invited to a reception at the press president's house at Vassar. And so we were off, my husband and I, at this president's reception, and Sammy was off with her resident advisor group. And all of a sudden, we had planned to meet her at 4 o'clock, but we get this frantic text from her, and she goes, "Where are you? It's the leaving time."
Oh.
And I was just very taken by that, because here she was, a college freshman, and that was such a childlike term,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it just made me think that's exactly what kids are always afraid of, that parents are going to disappear.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to be the perfect little backstory for Jenna and her mom. When Jenna is little, she has this morbid fear that if she closes her eyes to take a nap, her mother's going to disappear. And of course, that's exactly what happens to her.
And the phrase is in the book, mm-hmm. But it's kind of late in the book. So I wonder if you went in and dug that out. Or if you knew...
No, I knew that. I actually added it in, mm-hmm. afterward. Mm-hmm. I knew in my head why I was calling it that. But then I added that scene in to resonate with it. You know, it made sense from a thematic point of view. It was the leaving time. But I needed to see the scene. So it was part of the revision.
So you've been hugely successful after those first books that only sold a few thousand copies or 100 copies,
yeah,
or whatever.
Right.
But now there are some people who have objected to some of your books. And I wonder, like, what the combination is of feeling like you were part of a really prestigious list and maybe some outrage at the same time, even though, you know, it might ultimately be good for sales of the book. Mm.
So, I mean, it's always, in my opinion, an honor to make it to a banned book list. You are in excellent company if you make it there. And there was a point when My Sister's Keeper was one of the top 10 banned books of the year that, you know, it came out. That was actually quite a feather in my cap. The thing about a banned book, though, you know, in a serious way, is that it's a very slippery slope to ban a book, because it is the beginning of telling someone how you are supposed to think. And that, to me, is a great and grave danger. I also think it is very depressing when people take something out of context. They don't read the book, for example, before they object to it. And what they do is get very upset about a word, a phrase, a page, when in reality, in context, it thematically works with exactly what the book is trying to teach you. And the book is doing some great, great good. Usually the books that push the buttons of parents are the ones that are getting their kids talking and thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, as a parent, I would much rather read a book like that with my kid and have a conversation than pretend that scary things like sex and drugs and bullying don't exist.
I wonder if parents, I mean, there are adult books that get banned as well, which is a whole other category of behavior. But I wonder if parents have trouble transitioning from the time when you hand a child a book and it comes with like a moral lesson and there's a guarantee that something is going to happen in the end that has taught you something. And then mm-hmm. there's the point where literature really isn't all about that. It's also mm-hmm. just about exploring the human condition.
Yeah. And I actually think the problem is that sometimes it's hard to let go as parents and let our kids think for themselves. And ultimately, that's the point of fiction, I think. The point of fiction is not to chronicle the way things are, which is what nonfiction is, but to have the opportunity to possibly change the way things will be by opening minds. And ultimately, that can be very scary for a parent, because what if your child winds up believing something different than what you taught them?
Then it means you failed miserably and you're a terrible human being.
Or you created a child who might be able to teach you something.
Right, right. So is your daughter still writing?
Yeah, she is. She actually, you know, called me up in January of last year. That was the happy ending to Leaving Time. She still actually calls me. and so it was January and she called me and said, I really miss writing. And I said, you write every day. She said, yeah, but I don't write. And she said, I was thinking maybe we could write the sequel to Between the Lines and maybe I could get course credit for it. I said, well, see what you can do there. And she did. She wound up writing it over the summer with me and getting course credit at Vassar. And it's being published in May. It's called Off the Page.
Oh, that's really exciting.
Yeah, it's really great.
So I read some advice that you gave to aspiring writers, which is, I'm paraphrasing here, but you essentially said, I get the first draft out because I can edit garbage, but I can't edit
a blank
nothing.
Page. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I started writing when, like you said, you know, 20 years ago, I had tiny kids. I had three children under the age of four. And I was the primary caretaker, and I was writing a novel a year.
So lots of free time.
Lots of free time. But exactly. I got used to writing when, you know, Barney was on TV, when they weren't hitting each other with blocks. I used to take my laptop to nursery school pickup, and I would put it on the steering wheel and type until Kyle was brought out to the car. You know, whatever it took, any mm-hmm. 5 minutes that I had. And when you don't have a lot of time and you want to write, you sit down and you write. And, you know, sometimes it's not very good, but you have to have something there to work with. Now, and actually even back when organized school started for my kids, I suddenly had 8 hours a day to write. That was a huge gift. And I think I carried that lesson with me, that idea that if your butt goes into the chair, it's time to write. And I still do it today. You know, I get asked a lot about writer's block. I just don't believe in it because I didn't have the luxury of time. And when you don't have the luxury of time, you don't get writer's block.
Is reading part of the writing process for you, reading beyond research?
Oh, yeah, because it inspires you. I mean, how many times do you read a book and go, God, why didn't I write that? That's exactly what you want. You want to constantly be thinking about the next story you're going to tell and how you're going to tell it as well as that particular writer did.
How well do you think writers communicate with one another?
Very, very infrequently. You know, there's actually a line in the book where Jenna asks Serenity, well, do you know another psychic who can help me? And she says, we don't all hang out at the Paranormal right. Cafe on Wednesday nights. Well, we don't hang out at the Writer Cafe either.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't until much later in my career that I even met another writer. And usually it was because we were paired at a literary festival and maybe we hit it off.
Mm-hmm.
But now when I do get to meet people, you know, I get to fangirl out too, which is kind of exciting. You know, I recently met Kathy Reichs, for mm-hmm. example. She's great. She's so smart, you know, because she's a scientist, really, and then she kind of writes on the side. And because of that, her books are brilliant and technical and accurate and phenomenally educational as you're reading them. And I love that. I love that about her writing. So it was really exciting to meet her in the flesh. And, you know, I still feel that way when I get to meet certain authors. When I met John Grisham, it was at the National Book Festival for the first time. And he came up to me and he goes, your books are all over my house. You know, that great drawl of his. And it was really fun, you know, to connect with people who you've read for years and to get to meet them on a personal level. But the truth is we don't often get to do that because we all work independently in our own little offices places, you know.
You're so animated sitting here across the desk, and I wonder about the isolation that writing requires and whether that's always been easy for you.
There are, I think, two kinds of writers. There are extroverts and introverts, and most writers are introverts. And you kind of have to be a bit of an introvert to be a good writer because you have to go deep into yourself and squeeze everything out on a page. But then there are some of us who are really just frustrated actresses. And to some extent, the reason I really love touring and the reason I still do it after all this time, when really I don't have to tour. You know, I don't have to go out and pound the streets and get people to, you know, wave my book around and say, please read me, please read me. I'm really fortunate because I've reached a level in my career where a lot of people hear about my books through other media, and that's great. But I go on tour not for that. I go on tour to meet my fans. I want to see who's reading my books. I get sales figures, but that's not the same thing as hearing someone say, I was crying so hard at the end of My Sister's Keeper on a plane that the flight attendant asked if I needed medical attention. You know, I want to hear your stories too. And that's what happens when I go on book tour. It's the end of the equation, the other side of the transaction. Mary Higgins Clark is still, as far as I know, touring. She's in her 80s. I mean, what a great role model. And she does it, again, not because she's trying to sell books. She does it because she wants to say thank you. And I think that's vitally important.
How do you politely extricate yourself from a conversation when someone's got an awesome idea for you to write a novel about?
I do it at least 10 times a day.
Mm-hmm.
I get emails saying, I have the best idea for a book. You need to write the story of my life, usually. or I have this dread disease and I think you're the only person who can tell the world about it. What I usually say is entirely the truth. I'm not going to write your book. I have plenty of ideas of my own that I have to get to. And they need to strike me personally for them to be good. They may not have happened to me, but they need to intersect somewhere in my life that has me thinking about that issue. And if you have a great idea for the book, it is your book. Sit down and write it. You may not be a writer. What I recommend is thinking not of writing the entire quilt, but of quilt squares. Write moments, memories, dialogue, tiny little bits that you can conceive and put down on paper. You can always hire somebody to cobble it together. But your initial feelings and thoughts and emotions are what's going to make that book saleable and readable and emotional. And that's ultimately why it's your story.
So we had James Ellroy in here a couple of weeks ago, and based on the way he writes, he can have a character that literally appeared in two scenes for about a paragraph each and then bring him completely, you know, to life in a new book. I wonder if you've ever had a character that you've used before and thought, I wasted that character because I would love to put this person into this story.
I've done it. I actually will bring characters back if I feel like I haven't finished telling their story yet. So there's a lawyer named Jordan McAfee who has reappeared in, I think, three of my books now. The first time I brought him back, it was because he had moved on in his life and I wanted readers to know where he wound up. And the second time I brought him back, it was because he's a defense attorney and I had a client for him. Mm-hmm. And there's another character, Patrick Ducharme, who is a detective who's appeared in two books, mostly because I have a big crush on him. So I will bring characters back. And there are some that I think about whose stories I haven't finished telling yet. And I'm sure they will return at some point.
How does that work? Do you just like you're taking a walk in the morning and you're waiting for them to tell you, all right, my time has come?
Yeah. You know what it is? I actually was talking about this at an event a few days ago and I coined this new term. They are in my head all the time and I think about them and I wonder, oh, what is Chris Hart doing now from the pack? Did he do okay in college? Did he ever fall in love again? And that's what I want to know. And my world really is populated with these discarded, you know, characters. And I was calling it the Jodyverse. And I said, we should make that happen. Hashtag Jodyverse, you know. So I'm excited by everyone who's been tweeting that. So go out there, everyone in Texas. Hashtag Jodyverse. But, you know, it is. It's very real to me where these characters live and that they inhabit this world that I guess, you know, connects all my books together somehow with lots of crazy fictional people. But they are out there and I do worry about them. And the ones I worry the most about will come back.
It's clear when you're doing research that you don't want to show up and be a dilettante, right? That you've done some research before you actually ask someone to, you know, walk mm-hmm. you through
yes.
the process of something. I wonder, though, as you get to know people, how much you allow yourself to take personal attributes from some of the people you meet at an elephant sanctuary mm-hmm. or anywhere else, and how you sort of work through attaching those qualities to people that will appear in books.
I do that. You know, I get asked a lot, do you know are your characters based off people you know? And they're not really, because like I said, those voices kind of come to me in my head, but they are shaped by the people I interview. So that's very true. Chip Coffey, you know, like I said, is so funny and so engaging as a psychic that a lot of his mannerisms and speech patterns became serenities. I just was laughing the whole time I was with him, and Serenity makes me laugh because I love the way she thinks. And by the same token, Patrick Ducharme looks physically like a detective that I worked with for years doing research in my hometown, who is the nicest guy. And, you know, so that was like my little gift to him. You know, let's make a character who looks like you somehow. So every now and then I will take an attribute and, you know, funnel it into someone. There's a character in The Storyteller who is a Nazi hunter. And his name is Leo. He's based off a real life man who does this for a living at the Department of Justice. And again, the way he described his job to me was so vivid that a lot of his descriptions wound up coming out of Leo's mouth. So very often I'll do that. I'll steal stuff that somebody says to me and I will give it to the character.
The last thing I want to ask is, if you have lots of ideas percolating at one time, how do you put them in order?
So I said a little bit earlier that an idea has to strike me personally. Mm-hmm. And by that I mean that there are things that keep me awake at night as a mom, a wife, a woman, an American, things I worry about. And if I keep getting awakened by a thought thinking, what would I have done here? Or what if this happened? It's probably a really good idea for a book. But what I think is a really great idea right now might not have been a great idea 5 years ago. Hmm. So if you actually look at the trajectory of my writing career, I began with a mother-daughter book kind of like this, but I was closer in age to the daughter at the time.
Yeah.
Now I'm closer in age to the mother. Then I began to write about what relationships were like because I got married. Are they ever 50-50? Are they 70-30? How do you judge that? Then I had kids and I wrote for many years about all the scary things that could happen to your child, you know, kidnapping and illness and death and school shootings, all those things in, you know, many different formats. And then my kids got old enough to fend for themselves mm-hmm. and I began to get a little more theoretical. You know, how do you end life and what's the nature of good and evil? So eventually I'll probably write about putting your parents in a rest home.
Jodi Picoult's latest novel is called Leaving Time. She's in town to speak tonight at SMU's Hughes Trigg Theater as part of the Highland Park United Methodist Church's Authors Live series. Jodi, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.